It was the first day of my time in seminary in New York City, and it was hot. Middle of August, heavy, humid, urine-perfumed air, New York City hot. Sarah and I had unloaded our Ryder truck after a grueling four-day marathon across the country that had almost ended our marriage before it even began. Now that's a story, but it's actually several stories, and that's for another day. And I made my way onto the General Seminary campus to find the mailroom. Now, I was still getting my bearings, this being we had just arrived, and so as I walked around a corner on the campus, I saw one of my soon-to-be professors talking with a very animated and possibly agitated homeless man. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, this homeless man did not wear a sign identifying himself as homeless. There was no official button or tag or t-shirt to say this. I just knew it. He was a tall, slender man in his early 50s with a long, bushy gray beard, a worn t-shirt, frayed cut-off jeans, some busted-up sandals, and a bright, and I mean bright pink, trucker mesh baseball cap. So he didn't have a sign on that said homeless, but it was clear, right? It was hot, I was tired, and the closer that I got, the more agitated he seemed to get. And I looked, and I thought, well, Professor Richardson seems to have a handle on the situation. And on I went past, thinking no more of the encounter. Until I got to the first day of the first class of my seminary career, and who was my section tutor? This doctoral candidate in theology who had been an Episcopal priest for about 15 years. Right, a man named Father Rob Schwarz, who is now the priest in charge of the Standing Rock Reservation in South Dakota and is now a good friend and a mentor and loves this story. Homeless? Not so much. Just someone on his way back from vacation in a righteous pink ball cap telling an animated story about his bad luck fishing. So there you have it. Sight. It ain't what it used to be. Samuel had no shocking headwear to skew his vision, but had similar problems in seeing what was before him. Do you remember Samuel's job? Samuel was a prophet, and a prophet's position is by nature precarious, living between a rock in God and a very hard place in the kingdom. It was the prophet's duty to hear the word of God and then to tell it to the king, good news or bad. And the tight spot was about to get even tighter. Because while Saul was still in power, Samuel was told to go and anoint the next king. And current kings don't seem to be too fond of that. Feeling trepidatious, and really, who wouldn't, Samuel sets out to find Jesse of Bethlehem and his sons. And once he has assured the concerned citizenry that he was on a mission from God, kind of makes me wonder, did God engage in deception with this sacrifice? So once he has assured the local citizenry, Samuel got to the task of figuring out who would next lead the kingdom. Naturally, he started out with the oldest son, Eliab, a tall, studly young man. So Samuel thought, well, he must be the one. But just as Samuel was reaching for the horn of oil to anoint Eliab, the voice of the Lord came to the prophet and said something like this. It's a different version. Not that one. You look at the outside appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And so it went. Up stepped Abinadab, and down stepped Abinadab. And up stepped Shema, and down stepped Shema. For all seven sons. Now, I have to imagine, if you're Samuel, that with each son that steps down, Samuel gets to be a bit more nervous. Until finally, Jesse has David, his youngest, fetched from the fields where he was watching the sheep, and there he was, the runt, the next king of Israel, slingshot and all. Apparently, you've got to know what to look for, or perhaps more accurately, how to look. Am I alone, or has anyone else ever walked into a situation in which you knew who the other person was? I mean, even if you've never met this person in your entire life, but one look, and you knew who they were, what they did, and what to expect from them. Except when you don't. It's like these disciples who are walking down the road and they see this blind man. And they know not only that he's blind, but also that sin was at the root of his inability to see. And so they ask Jesus what they think to be a pretty run-of-the-mill, followers-ask-a-teacher kind of question. Who was it that sinned? This man or his parents? Because to them, what they see is a man born blind, and so therefore, a sin must be paid for as long as he will live. Jesus' answer is interesting. For one thing, he actually answers the question, right? This is not something that Jesus often does. But here, he is clear to say that there is no sin. Not with this man, nor with his parents. Sin is not at issue here. Now, I'd like to say that this is simply an ancient belief that when people suffer physically, whether from blindness or cancer or other disease, that we used to think that it was because of a notorious sin. But friends, this is not simply a false belief of the past. It is one that has lived on to our time and place. To be clear, it would be silly to say that sin never causes suffering, because there clearly is suffering in this world, both individual and corporate, that is caused by our own sin or by the sin of others. But the reverse is simply not always true. Just because someone is suffering does not mean that they are being punished by God for a wrongdoing. To borrow some elementary school geometry, every square may be a rectangle, but not every rectangle is a square. And in this situation, Jesus is saying it's not about cause. Pay attention to effect. We need to see with something more than just our eyes. Because after some spit, some kneading, some mud and a wash in the pool of Siloam, this man born blind can see for the first time in his life. And then the fun really starts. Because even though something has changed dramatically and for the better, it is not a change that everyone else is ready to see. First, to have trouble seeing this newly sighted man are his neighbors. "Can it really be you?" they ask. "No, probably someone just like you." Now, this raised enough questions that the man is hauled before the Pharisees, one of the groups of religious authority. And in the typical fashion of those unable or unwilling to see this remarkable change in front of them, they are armed with the litany of reasons why this cannot be. And so they offer official reason number one. You didn't follow the rules. It was done on the Sabbath, and you can't knead on the Sabbath bread or mud, so it didn't happen. Sometimes it's hard to see something even when it's right there in front of your eyes because we haven't done it that way. We haven't seen it that way before. Then this blind man's parents are dragged in for official reason number two. And that's that this man actually wasn't blind, that you've got the wrong guy. Now this would be starting to be a little humorous if it weren't so serious. Finally, this man who had been born blind is called in again, and this is what makes the Pharisees' inability to see so stunningly apparent. For when asked how Jesus opened his eyes, now remember, this man is clearly at a point of frustration. He's told his story several times now. So he asks, well, do you want to be disciples of this man as well? Now, this was more than the blind authorities could bear. So out comes official reason number three of why this cannot be. And it is an official reason that has been used by religious communities from then until this very day. You must be a heretic. So they did what we always do with heretics. They drove the man out. Cut him off from his community. This story, like many in the Gospel of John, lives in the irony of those on the outside being brought in and those on the inside placing themselves out. Because in this story, in this good news, as one scholar has written, sight and blindness are not defined by one's physical sight, but by one's openness to the revelation of God in Jesus. Those unable to see the light cannot see the world for what it is, but those looking with the light will see and will believe. But what will they or us see? What will they or we, what will we be able to believe? For us, as for the Pharisees and for the man born blind, seeing the world in this light will necessarily force us into seeing more than we may be ready for. When we open our eyes to the world to look in another way, to see anew, once we see in this way, things change. Right? What will I do when I can no longer place people in convenient and errant categories? What would happen next? What will this do to my clean and ordered and controlled life? Am I ready to see with new eyes? Here's a thought as you gear up for this next week. At some point this week, you will be coming face to face with a stranger. Now, I don't mean to sound like some dramatically ambiguous horoscope. With Mars in retrograde, pursue your many options with a single-minded focus. No, the chances are that this actually will happen. Someone new will come into your work. An old acquaintance will friend you on Facebook. As you turn a corner, you will come face to face with someone who is strange to you. Someone different will cross your path at school. And you will have a moment faced with a choice. Now these moments, they come and they go, but with each moment, we have the opportunity to see a person anew. More often than not, we let that moment pass, dodging or avoiding. But this week, encounter that moment with intention, with prayer even. Try not to look at the outward appearance as Samuel is reminded, or what that person has always been like as the Pharisees noted. Look instead with this light of Christ, which looks to the heart, to their heart and to your heart. And in that moment, or if you're in the right space, in that series of moments, be open to the reality that God is present. And seeing may just be believing.